Okay, so good morning, everybody. And we are resuming our study of indeterminates and cosmic determinations. Shyam, do you have an indication where we are? Is it the paragraph beginning, but an approach from the material end of existence?
Just a minute, I have that with me.
Last time we finished by reading without commentary the following paragraph that starts, "It is only when we follow."
Yeah, that's my
Okay.
bookmark too.
Okay, good. So, just to contextualize what we are studying right now, Sri Aurobindo has stated his hypothesis, which is regarding the nature of the creator and the creation. And what he's talking about is that what appears to be inconscient is really another self-presentation of being, of conscious being. And he takes up a number of approaches to explain why this particular self-presentation appears as it does, and hones in on three. One being the possibility that it is an evolving reality. Just one second. Sorry. Sorry about that. So, it's an evolving reality that has a certain immanence to it. That is, the conscious being is present, but it is present as something which is within the inconscient reality. So, the three approaches that he takes on for the hypothesis is one is that there is a difference, a distinction between that conscious being and the inconscient. In other words, it's the what we call the hylomorphic view, that is, or the creator-creation view, which is that the transcendent cosmic being is molding or guiding or in some way extra cosmically designing the cosmos. The second one is that of a transcendence within the immanence. In other words, that such a creation has been made and this transcendental being has entered into the base of this, like a cosmic presence, and that it is guiding it from within, but from within the entire cosmos. In other words, the constituents of the cosmos are separated from the transcendence, which remains transcendent but inside the immanence. It's a layer which is inaccessible within the immanence. And the third one is that this thing that we call the creation is nothing other than a self-presentation of conscious being. In other words, every element in it, everything that we can call an element in it, is the totality of that being. So the immanence goes all the way down. The immanence is one in which there is no distinction between something external and its elements. So, of the three, Sri Aurobindo features or foregrounds the third. But as he develops his hypothesis, we find that he's actually presenting a situation in which all these three possibilities coexist. They coexist in this form. So to summarize, there is a transcendent, or rather maybe we should put it the other way around, that there is a absolute immanence. In other words, the entire conscious being is present in each of its immanent elements. There is a transcendence within the immanence. In other words, what Sri Aurobindo has called nature with a capital N, that is a kind of energy or power of the cosmos, a cosmic shakti, if we want to call it that. And there is also a transcendent being that is conscious and extra cosmic, that is outside of the creation. Now, the way you can understand this, the ontology of this, the way in which Sri Aurobindo describes this coexistence, is as simultaneous self-presentations of being. In other words, being can look upon itself in infinite ways, and all of them are self-present to it. Being is simultaneously transcendent. In other words, it can look upon itself as self-immersed and separate from any creation. It can look upon itself as a creator. In other words, that it is standing outside of a manifestation. It can look upon itself as something that has entered into the manifestation but not its elements, and is guiding it from behind as a transcendence within the immanence. And it can look upon itself as something which is completely involved in a kind of an inconscience, and out of that inconscience is awakening into its own reality in a kind of a ad infinitum way, because if it is totally involved, it is infinitely present, and its self-exploration will accordingly be perpetual. It will go on forever. So, of these three, the complete immanence is the one that is the most important of the three. And the reason is that we don't find that an extra cosmic creator, a creator like what we call God with a capital G, outside of the creation, interferes that much with the creation. We don't find some kind of constant intervention, as it were. On the other hand, we don't also find that there is some kind of a automatism that is guiding the evolution. Now, when we look at it, we find that these are both partially true. There are sort of elements of what we may call intelligent design in the creation. There are elements of some kind of an inevitability in the unfoldment of the evolution. But these are not entirely true. They are partially true. They only show themselves as hints. What is more true is the effort and struggle by which the evolution takes place. And this is what gives us a greater philosophical confidence in the immanence of the conscious being in each of its elements. In other words, each element in the cosmos has a will, and that will is a will to express the fullness of that conscious being. And that is what guides the evolution. I think it's echoing. I think somebody is not not present. Okay. So, this is the hypothesis that Sri Aurobindo sets up. And now, from this hypothesis, he moves to trying to tell us how can we be sure of it? How can we, do we have any access to verify this? And this is Sri Aurobindo's method, because he will follow this kind of a method in his own life, where he experiments with the hypothesis in his own experience. He subjectively tries to verify these things, because his hypothesis itself assumes that it is possible to experience states of consciousness that are extra personal, that go beyond the person into more cosmic or universal states of consciousness. Now here, where we stand right now, Sri Aurobindo begins by the paragraph before the one we read last, which begins, "But an approach from the material end of existence cannot give us any certitude of validity for this hypothesis." Now, that paragraph is also a very key, important, and critical paragraph, because Sri Aurobindo, in trying to amplify his hypothesis, has pointed out how everything in the cosmos contains everything else. That the body, in a sense, contains the mind, and that we find the mind contains the body, but that each one of these forms of consciousness is a certain operation of consciousness, and that operation of consciousness is held in place by the attention of the conscious being, and hence the other properties are backgrounded and only exist as translations into that operation. In other words, what Sri Aurobindo later talks of as the cross-linkages of being. You would have a vital mind, a material mind, etc., to mind consciousness. Similarly, to the vital, you'd have a vital mentality, or a kind of a mind component to the vital. You'd have a physical component to the vital, etc. So these are the cross linkages that make possible those other forms of consciousness and communication possibilities between these different self-presentations of being. But though it is technically or potentially possible to contact the entirety of conscious being at any level, the reason Sri Aurobindo embarks upon that paragraph where he says an approach from the material end of existence cannot give us any certitude of validity is because, as he points out, the self-involvement of conscious being, what we call the inconscient, because it's the involution, is something which obscures consciousness to a very great degree, and the kind of the property of self-expression in these more inconscient levels makes it impossible to unravel the fullness of consciousness there in experience. I shouldn't say impossible, because it is always potentially possible, but it's very difficult. And this is the reason why this kind of a model of consciousness that Sri Aurobindo lays out can be compared, I made the point last time, to certain forms, certain Baroque forms of ontology, as for example that by Leibniz, who talks about being as folded, that there are many folds in being. Each one of these folds contains all the rest, but foregrounds certain properties. So this is the sense in which we find what we call the lower planes actually contain all the higher planes, but the access to to those planes is much more limited. So in the theory of the fold, Leibniz would say that as a matter of fact, everything in the cosmos, these tables, chairs, and other material things, no less than dogs, cats, and other animals, plants, and human beings, have the entirety of the cosmos consciously present in them, but only a certain amount of it actually mobilized in their self-consciousness. See, the rest of it is latent and asleep. So this is nature. Nature is making this kind of a progressive manifestation of its properties. Now, within this, if we are to actually experience this theory, it would be possible at a higher stage than the human or than the mind and whatever of the mind we've experienced so far in the human. And Sri Aurobindo's theory is already presaging that, because he's saying it's an evolution. It's not static. It isn't as if this spectrum of consciousness has been laid out and that's how things are. The reason everything is changing is both because this involved consciousness is constantly trying to evolve all the properties of conscious being from within it, and because these three forms of relationship that I just mentioned, the transcendent, the transcendent within the immanent, and the total immanence, these are in relation with each other. This is one of the kind of really brilliant kind of ways of conceptualizing that we find here in Sri Aurobindo, that they're not separated from each other because these are simultaneous self-presentations of being. Hence, they are in relation with each other. And this relation causes the evolution to proceed in a certain manner, where that which is immanent in the elements is drawing on that which is transcendent to it. So that process of aspiration and descent is taking place, which is actually motivating this evolution. Now, we can say from that at a certain level, the entire evolution is already present. Okay? So that though by agency, each element is striving and struggling to explore and express more and more of this consciousness, it is really like a pattern that already exists, which it is filling up. There's a very beautiful line by the poet W.B. Yeats, which seems similar to this. He has a line in which he's talking about Plato, Platonic philosophy, and he says, "Plato thought nature but a spume that plays upon a paradigm of things." So the paradigm exists behind, and nature is a spume like spray that is playing on top of it and making it visible, because it's taking the shapes of the paradigm as it falls. It doesn't take any random shape, but it's taking the kind of shapes that are already laid out behind. And that's the reason why Sri Aurobindo can say that if we are to look for a solution, we have to look for it at a level which already exists, but not yet here in the cosmos. So this is a very bold step where Sri Aurobindo's thinking swings away or swings out of the ambit of Western philosophy. Particularly from this point on, it connects with the Indian discursive tradition, because there this assumption is intrinsic that yoga and darshana or philosophy cannot be separated. So one has to verify in experience what is being thought of in concept. That's exactly where we are, and Sri Aurobindo has taken us from this point of verifying that the material existence does not give us enough access. And then from the next paragraph, which we had read and we should read again today, he points out what we can do to see if such access is possible.
I can read the first paragraph. So we start with page 322. It starts with, it is only. It is only when we follow the yogic process of quieting the mind itself that a profounder result of our self-observation becomes possible. For first, we discover that the mind is a subtle substance, a general determinate or generic indeterminate, which mental energy, when it operates through it, throws into forms or particular determinations of itself, thoughts, concepts, percepts, mental sentiments, activities of will and reactions of feeling, but which, when the energy is quiescent, can live either in an inert torpor or an immobile silence and peace of self-existence. Next, we see that the determinations of our mind do not all proceed from itself. For waves and currents of mental energy enter into it from outside. These take form in it or appear already formed from some universal mind or from other minds and are accepted by us as our own thinking. We can perceive also an occult or subliminal mind in ourselves from which thoughts and perceptions and will impulses and mental feelings arise. We can perceive too higher planes of consciousness from which a superior mind energy works through us or upon us. Finally, we discover that that which observes all this is a mental being supporting the mind substance and mind energy. Without this presence, their upholder and source of sanctions, they could not exist or operate. This mental being or Purusha first appears as a silent witness. And if that were all, we would have to accept the determinations of mind as a phenomenal activity imposed upon the being by nature, by Prakriti, or else as a creation presented to it by Prakriti, a world of thought which nature constructs and offers to the observing Purusha. But afterwards, we find that the Purusha, the mental being, can depart from its posture of a silent or accepting witness. It can become the source of reactions, accept, reject, even rule and regulate, become the giver of the command, the knower. And knowledge also arises that this mind substance manifests the mental being, is its own expressive substance, and the mental energy is its own consciousness force. So that it is reasonable to conclude that all mind determinations arise from the being of the Purusha. But this conclusion is complicated by the fact that from another viewpoint, our personal mind seems to be little more than a formation of universal mind, an engine for the reception, modification, propagation of cosmic thought waves, idea currents, will suggestions, waves of feelings, sense suggestions, form suggestions. It has no doubt its own already realized expression, predispositions, propensities, personal temperament and nature. What comes from the universal can only find a place there if it is accepted and assimilated into the self-expression of the individual mental being, the personal prakriti of the Purusha. But still, in view of these complexities, the question remains entire whether all this evolution and action is a phenomenal creation by some universal energy presented to the mental being or an activity imposed by mind energy on the Purusha's indeterminate, perhaps indeterminable existence, or whether the whole is something predetermined by some dynamic truth of self within and only manifested on the mind surface. To know that, we would have to touch or enter into a cosmic state of being and consciousness to which the totality of things and their integral principle would be better manifest than to our limited mind experience.
So here we find that Sri Aurobindo is laying out the beginnings of the process by which we may come to some kind of verification of his theory. And the first step that he points to is the quieting of the mind. And he's doing this because it's possible to arrive at a greater sense of being conscious, of consciousness, of our own operations by quieting the mind, which is not possible to the same extent at the other levels of being. Now, we may try to impose silence on the body, in other words, a great stillness of the body. This is what, for example, the Hatha yogins do, which has become quite a popular aspect of yoga in today's world. The attempt to still the body awakens the physical purusha. But the physical purusha has a certain amount of control over the body. The physical purusha's activities are similar or mimic, mimic is not the right word, I'd say correspond to the activities of the mental purusha, in that it can experience its freedom from the activities of the physical prakriti. It can also experience a certain amount of control, particularly the control of negation, of stopping the activities of the prakriti. But it cannot have a proper understanding of the higher levels of consciousness, for example, of the life energies or of the mentality. It stops at the level of the body, and this is the reason why Hatha Yoga has to supplement itself through opening up the other two bodies and attempting to get at the other two purushas. It does this through pranayama, which allows it to get at the prana purusha to some extent. Those who are experts at pranayama manage to arrive at the prana purusha. But then we have just the ability to know the life currents, the currents of prana, as separate from the prana purusha and have some amount of control over them, which is what people who use pranic healing or the martial arts, highly developed in East Asia, they are involved in that. Both these forms of opening up the purusha, however, do not give us access to the levels where the meaning of existence becomes clear to us. It only gives us a certain amount of power at certain levels of being. With the mind, we find that it's already easier to separate from its activities. The reason for this is that the purusha has itself been evolving with the evolution of prakriti, and its control and freedom is increasing as prakriti's levels of freedom increase. So, at the level of mind, we find the mental purusha is already able to influence the prakriti enough so that an instrument has been developed in the prakriti to study the activities of the prakriti itself. This is the buddhi or intellect. The ability to reflect on ourselves, a self-reflexive property, is a sure sign of the presence and independence of the purusha to a certain extent at the mind level. If we understand it in this way, it becomes clearer to us why Sri Aurobindo is proposing that we use the silence of the mind to get further than the mind. Now, mental activities, just like physical and vital activities, are also driven by some automatisms. And this is how we lead our ordinary lives. Our thinking is patterned after various kinds of environing conditionings. And that's the reason why we cannot arrive clearly at this this consciousness which gives us access to the totality of pure consciousness. But if we learn how to still the mind, then we find that we suddenly become aware of the presence of a witness. Now, this entire paragraph that Sri Aurobindo talks about sort of, in a way summarizes some of the thinking that goes behind the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, where essentially he begins by talking about the fact that yoga is the stilling of the tendencies towards thought, tendencies of consciousness towards self-expression. In other words, the prakritic movements. Now, when he points out when we do this, then we find ourselves as a pure witness. Consciousness becomes a witnessing consciousness. And the activities of the mind are witnessed by it as so many, you know, thoughts that are floating on the surface of the mental consciousness. But then that's not all. The mind affords us a vantage from which we can rise higher or go lower, particularly rise higher. And that's why he's saying that we see that the determinations of our mind do not proceed from itself, for waves and currents of mental energy enter into it from outside. So this is one of our discoveries, that the witness sees that we are not self-contained thinkers, that thought is flowing in from outside. They take form in it or appear already formed from some universal mind or from other minds and are accepted by us as our own thinking. This line is very important because it completely changes our self-conception. Our ego doesn't disappear but undergoes a big change. We start seeing the relational nature of things, and we also start seeing our dependence on a universal being. We also start observing other layers of mind within ourselves and in the cosmos. We can perceive also an occult or subliminal mind in ourselves from which thoughts and perceptions and will impulses and mental feelings arise. We can perceive two higher planes of consciousness from which a superior mind energy works through or upon us. Finally, we discover that that which observes all this is a mental being supporting the mind substance and mind energy. Without this presence, their upholder and source of sanctions, they could not exist or operate. So, mind, one of the things we realize by taking the witness poise, the personal witness poise, is that mental activity is not being generated by it. Mental activity is being controlled by it. It's like a controller of something which is already given to it. Second thing we realize is that this mental activity is proceeding from a variety of sources, but ultimately coming from something invisible, a higher cosmic mind. The third thing we realize is that we have some access to this higher cosmic mind, that we have deeper layers of internal or subliminal mind within us that connects us to a universal mind substance, and also that we can rise higher than what the human mind is capable of expressing and become aware of higher properties of mind. Now, this entire line of thinking is a very important one. It's very important because even in the Eastern traditions, yogas have not developed this line of understanding sufficiently. The attempt there has been to still the mind just as we still the life and the body, and then to jump into another, like a quantum leap, into another level of consciousness where the mind falls, becomes effete and is no longer utilized. Now, this is not Sri Aurobindo's aim, because his aim is a transformed life on earth. And one of the great discoveries in that journey for that aim that he discovers is that the human being expresses only a very limited range of mind consciousness. That mind consciousness itself has many other levels to it that have not yet become manifest or embodied. They are manifested as influence, but not embodied by any creature in the physical cosmos that we know of. So, being able to contact these higher presences of mind consciousness allows us to have another kind of an appearance, understanding of being. And that's why a much freer and more cosmic understanding of being than what is available to us personally. So this is one very important point that he makes in this paragraph. The other really important point he makes is that arriving at the personal Purusha, we are still left with an enigma. That enigma is that Purusha can observe thoughts, can control thoughts by its veto power, by negating them, but it does not originate thoughts. The thoughts have come from elsewhere. This is the reason why mind consciousness gives us a certain look into the nature of reality, but is not the origin of reality, particularly not the origin of nature. So these are the two important lessons of that particular paragraph.
Devashish?
Yes.
Can you expand on that last point about how I think thoughts, you said thoughts are not coming from Purusha. Did I hear that correctly?
Yeah.
Can you just expand on that?
Okay, sure. Yeah, so, thank you, Owen. So, if you look towards the end of that paragraph, he's proposing three possibilities there, too. What he's saying is that, well, to back up, what he's saying is that by becoming the mental witness, at first we find that we only have the power to observe thoughts. But later, as we persist in that consciousness, we find that there's some agency to the mental Purusha. The agency lies in wishing away the thoughts. It's even more than wishing away, it's being able to completely stop the thoughts. Now, this happens because we realize that the activity of the mind, or the activity of the prakriti of the mind, depends on the sanction of the Purusha for continuing. And it's like a default sanction that it takes for granted. This is how nature works. So it's analogous to a property we see pretty frequently in normal, human life, where somebody, if you're not very aware, already assumes your assent. It assumes that you've said yes, and it starts operating. But you haven't really been consulted. So the moment you become aware of the fact that I have a choice in the matter, you can say no and cut the connection with that particular activity. This is what the mental Purusha can do. But even if it does that, it realizes that's about as far as its power goes. It cannot manufacture new thoughts. So then the question arises, where did these thoughts come from? And so what is the origin of these thoughts? And these are the three proposals he's making. I'm reading from there. But still, in view of these complexities, the question remains entire whether all this evolution and action is a phenomenal creation by some universal energy presented to the mental being. That is the first one. Or an activity imposed by mind energy on the Purusha's indeterminate, perhaps indeterminable existence. That's the second one. Or whether the whole is something predetermined by some dynamic truth of self within and only manifested on the mind surface. So here are three different points of origin that he's talking about. The first one is that of the transcendence within the immanence. Okay, this is the universal energy, like the nature energy, which is doing this evolution from behind, and that which through which it is doing its evolution is only like a passive medium with certain properties through which it can experience that evolution. So here what is happening is that it's the mental activity is coming about, and the mental Purusha can observe them, but it's really being created by this Prakriti within, the universal Prakriti, universal energy. The second one is that, this activity imposed by mind energy on the Purusha's indeterminate, perhaps indeterminable existence. So the second one is talking about this cosmic mind. So essentially that instead of some transcendence within the immanence, we have a lateral activity of cosmic mind. So something which is beyond the personal, but which is universal, is producing thoughts. There is a factory of thoughts there, and those are entering into the individual and being taken by it to be its own. It is being presented to the mental being. And then you have the whole as something predetermined by some dynamic truth of self within and only manifested on the mind surface. In other words, mental Purusha has only partial access to the origin of these thoughts, but some deeper self, say a psychic being, for example, may be producing the thoughts. These are the three proposals that he's making over here. And, you know, as we know, he's going to give again some partial credence to each of them, but the real answer is going to be that cosmic Purusha has got a certain vantage that individual Purusha does not have on these thoughts, but that even there, the division between the Purusha and the Prakriti, the cosmic Purusha and the activities of cosmic Purusha, are not completely unified. That ultimately these two are taking their origin in supermind, something above the mind consciousness altogether. This is the way in which Sri Aurobindo is going to arrive at supermind empirically over here, but he's driving us towards an empiricism that is not available to us without going through the yoga that he's pointing out.
Hello, this is Kika. What is the exact difference between the first and the second? Like, it seems that it's making a differentiating between universal energy and mind energy. So isn't mind energy part of universal energy, or how are they different?
Yeah, the difference as I see it is that the first one he's talking about is some universal energy presented to the mental being. Whether all this evolution and action is a phenomenal creation, right, by some universal energy presented to the mental being. So that I understand as a universal Prakriti. In other words, it's as if we are saying that there is a cosmic Kundalini, which there is, the cosmic divine mother, that is actually pushing the evolution forward. That's as what I understand by that first one. Now the second one is that an activity imposed. An activity imposed by mind energy on the Purusha's indeterminate, perhaps indeterminable existence. That is, we are talking there about either cosmic mind or over mind. So on the first hand, we are getting something which is immanent to the creation, not just mental, but like a universal Prakriti that is at the base of the entire evolving universe. And the other is a mental cosmic being. So a cosmic mind that is producing these thoughts.
So you're saying that universal energy is not really referring to a being, whereas mind energy is referring to a cosmic being?
No, I think both of them imply a being as well. The activity of the energy is a being itself, but one being is, the difference is that universal energy that is driving the cosmos will be not only mental, but will have vital and physical properties to it. Because it's like the divine mother at the base of the entire Prakriti. And the other one will have only mental properties to it.
Sorry, I'm part of class. Could you please repeat? I couldn't hear the first half of the answer.
Yeah, I'm saying that if we assume that there is a Prakriti to the evolution, that there is a universal Prakriti like a cosmic Kundalini, which is driving this this evolution and presenting itself as thoughts to the mental Purusha, then that is a being that has more than mental properties. In other words, it is also motivating the Prakritic movements of matter and life of the physical and vital forms of cosmic consciousness, as well as of the mental, while the other one is only responsible for mental thoughts. That's like a cosmic mind energy, so it's only producing mental thoughts, while the other is a presence behind the entire evolution.
So, in other words, the second is a subset of the first one?
We could talk about it as a subset, but if we take the first one to be a reality, then the second one doesn't need to be there at all. It does not need to have independent existence. In other words, we may say there can be a model of the cosmos in which these universal planes don't really exist, but are only provisionally generated by a cosmic Prakriti.
Okay, thank you.
So the Vajrasattva, when he says that there's this universal mental energy from which the thoughts are coming in, is he saying that at some point we'll be able, it's kind of implicit at this point, but at some later time when the mind, when the mental Purusha is active, we can actively pick and choose what's coming in and what's going out?
Yeah, we can. So he's saying that at this point itself, we can choose what's coming in and what's going out, because even if its origin is elsewhere, it is depending upon our choice to present itself to us. In other words, we don't have power over its generation, but we have power over whether we want to watch this movie or not. See? That's basically the amount of power. We can walk out of the cinema hall. But he's also saying that if we assume that there is a cosmic mind that is producing this, then we, since we can become aware through cosmic Purusha of the presence of a cosmic mind, we can try to identify ourselves with that cosmic mind and see whether we have any greater access to those thoughts or not. And that's exactly the what he's going to do with the next paragraph. And he's going to say, yes, we can arrive at the heights of cosmic mind existence in what I will call the overmind. This is what he's going to do.
Devashish?
Yeah.
In that same sentence, which we were just talking about, it says we can, where he says the mental energy, you know, the thoughts come from the outside, they come from a universal mind, or from other minds and are accepted by us as our own thinking. I think that the latter part of that, or from other minds, perhaps could be even as mundane as the thoughts from other people, from group thought, from the collective unconscious, if you will. You know, and not necessarily from a higher place, really, you know, from a much higher place. Or they could be higher thoughts generated from, you know, people like you and me, and or, you know, more evolved people, et cetera, et cetera. But I think that, you know, or from other minds and are accepted by our own thinking is pretty interesting. Even C.S. Lewis, for example, in the Screwtape Letters, kind of talks about two devils, Wormwood and I forget the other name, but kind of inserting thoughts, you know, floating thoughts towards the people, and then they accept these thoughts as their own. So I thought that was an interesting concept. Kind of opens up the door for more than just super cosmic forces and you know, thoughts from such higher places.
No doubt. Now, firstly, Owen, to point out, the sentence you read was not the sentence I read. It's not the same sentence. The sentence I was reading occurs towards the end of that paragraph. Mm-hmm. And it's the second last sentence from the bottom of the paragraph. It says, "But still, in view of these complexities, the question remains entire whether all this evolution and action, etc." Now, what he's doing over there, the reason he is not talking about the other minds there is he's in search for the origin of thoughts. The other minds do not originate thoughts either. Those thoughts are coming into the other minds just like they're coming into our mind from some other source. And so that lateral production of thoughts is only an illusion. Now, the reason he brings it up over there, the sentence you read, which is earlier, where he's raising this, again, it's hypothetical. You have to look at Sri Aurobindo's ors as purely hypothetical until he actually reasons it out. And he's not going to let it go over there. He's going to continue pursuing those ideas. But that, you're right, that is a very interesting idea. And it's the one where he's saying that these take form in it or appear already formed from some universal mind or from other minds and are accepted by us as our own thinking. Now, this is a reality. Each one of these propositions has a reality at some level or plane. So this line has a reality at the level of the mental Purusha, for which there is a relativism of thoughts, whether coming from above or coming from the same laterally, from the same level. So the way in which we receive thoughts is pre-digested. It's not all coming from above, but to some extent it's coming from around. And that's the point he's making. But what is coming from around is not an origin of thought. That's also a processing of thought, just like we are processing thoughts.
Aha. Yes. Thank
So, if there are no more questions or comments, we can move on to the next.
There was one more question. Right. So, saying that all the thoughts and that each person holds are all coming from this mental, you know, substance outside of each person, or is he saying that there's both cases where it's quote unquote manufactured within each Purusha, and also there's this thing outside that enters each person?
No, he's saying he's actually here proposing some possibilities, but eventually what he'll hone it down to is that, you know, the origin of these is not in any of these answers. It's really above all these in some extra mental consciousness where Purusha and Prakriti are seen to be one. Up to the heights of Prakriti, which is the heights of the mind, even the overmind, this union between Purusha and Prakriti doesn't take place. But to answer your question, what he's saying is that the way it works in our experience is that we feel the thoughts are coming either from above or from around or from within. Now, ultimately, they are all coming from above, but as he's saying that they require our, consent to generate themselves within us and be felt as our own property. It's just like, you know, you buy something from the market, but after a few days, you don't think that it came from outside. You think it's your property. It's basically the same thing, that we allow a home to external thoughts and then consider them to be our own thoughts, because they've sort of been imbued with our own identity, our ego. So that's how it operates. We are not generating any thoughts. We are just allowing a home due to our own prakritic constitution to a certain selection of thoughts, and then we are considering those thoughts to be generated by ourselves.
So in the physical realm, it's easy to conceptualize like us and outside of us. That equally tangible in the mental realm, that it's inside of us and outside of us, like that boundary, is that a very tangible boundary?
It's not a very tangible boundary, but the boundary becomes firstly more tangible if one silences the mind. That's the point he's making. It's only when we follow the yogic process of quieting the mind that a profounder result of our self-observation becomes possible. So when that happens, the witness can actually, particularly at the first stages, perceive this difference. And that's exactly what Sri Aurobindo is talking about regarding his own meditation that Lele introduced him to. He said, observe the thoughts coming into the mind from outside. He already assumes it and tells him, observe the thoughts coming into the mind from outside. And then Sri Aurobindo tells us he thought it was an outlandish idea because he'd never come across this idea before. But as soon as he tried, he saw indeed that thoughts were coming in from the outside and he could wish them away before they came in. In other words, he could sense them even prior to their entry into the mind, which is exactly like what you were saying. It's the outside and the inside is very distinct. But normally we don't feel that because we already habitually allow thoughts to inundate us and selectively take some of those as our own. So that's the first level. And the first level of this quieting of the mind does make the inside and outside much more clear. But then there is another level in which they become fuzzy again, which is, what are our boundaries in terms of the individual mind and cosmic mind when the Purusha starts expanding into the cosmic Purusha? Then we start losing the sense of our own individual boundaries because the mental Purusha itself experiences itself to be only a front of a greater Purusha. It's as if it's only an individualization of a much vaster self.
Devashish, when you were just speaking of these things, I just had an image, if I may share. That is like a river. If I get to the riverbed, which is closer to the ocean, it doesn't immediately make me aware of the fact that it's not that the water is there itself, it is constantly being refilled, and it's coming from some origin and passing by. Like it is not like in a container of water or the river bed doesn't really contain any water. So it doesn't really have an localized existence for that matter. It's like a phenomenal creation of as if like a it's like how far we are experiencing that flow or the range of that flow.
Absolutely. So it's to take that analogy, if you were sitting by the riverside and knew only that part of the river, you'd think that it's a pond. It's a pond whose limits you can't see, but it's just static water. But if you were able to climb high above it using a spaceship or a plane or something, then you'd see a much larger extent of that river and be able to see that perhaps the water is being constantly replenished, and that what you were looking at is basically a flow of water. So yeah, these perceptions change according to the state of one's consciousness.
So sitting in Santa Cruz, I can hear the train in Lodi. Maybe this is expanded consciousness, but it might just be Zachariah's microphone is on.
No, I don't think so. Oh, yes, yes. I'm sorry about that.
Well, that was pretty prescient to know exactly where you heard the train from. Okay, good. I guess what Owen was saying also comes in very handy in terms of, particularly at the level of thought control, where if we are aware of the fact that thoughts are coming in from our neighbors, from the conditionings of our environment, that's also very useful in being able to refuse the inundation of certain kinds of thoughts.
Yes, and Devashish reminded me of a little story that someone once told me, that it's like a bird that comes and lands on your head. The bird can come and circle around, and it can even sometimes land on your head, but you don't have to allow it to build a nest.
Yeah. Exactly. Very well put. Yes, that's exactly what the difference is. And that, as Sri Aurobindo says, that you can. Some yogis don't actually put a stop to all the thoughts, but they become free from the thoughts and allow them to pass. He also uses the metaphor of the flight of birds in the windless air. They're just flying across the horizons of your mind, basically, and you can watch them and appreciate them or wonder at them, but they have no sort of hold on you.
Just curious, this windless part, can you explain a little bit?
If I could find the passage, I'd read it. But essentially, it's one of the places where there's a number of places where he describes his own experience of nirvana, and in one of them, he talks about arriving at a point where the thoughts were like the flight of birds in a windless air. He says that so the windless air, I believe, is about the stillness of his own prakritic mental consciousness, which is completely still, and the thought, so that there's no muddying of the water. In other words, that he's not interfering with the thoughts, and the thoughts are just passing through, and he can watch them with absolute clarity and sort of see their form, shape, and movement, but not interfere in any way or be interfered by in any way by these thoughts.
Beautiful. So it's like no distraction or swaying.
Exactly. They have no, they don't distract at all. They don't have any influence or, can't affect the being in any way.
So shall we read the next paragraph?
Yeah.
John Robert, would you like to read next?
Sure, happy to. Over mind consciousness is such a state or principle beyond individual mind, beyond even universal mind in ignorance. It carries in itself a first direct and masterful cognition of cosmic truth. Here, then, we might hope to understand something of the original working of things, get some insight into the fundamental movements of cosmic nature. One thing indeed becomes clear. It is self-evident here that both the individual and the cosmos come from a transcendent reality which takes form in them. The mind and life of the individual being, itself in nature, must therefore be a partial self-expression of the cosmic being, and, both through that and directly, a self-expression of the transcendent reality. A conditional and half-veiled expression it may be, but still, that is its significance. But also, we see that what the expression shall be is also determined by the individual himself. Only what he can in his nature receive, assimilate, formulate, his portion of the cosmic being or of the reality, can find shape in his mind and life and physical parts. Something that derives from the reality, something that is in the cosmos, he expresses, but in the terms of his own self-expression, in the terms of his own nature. But the original question set out for us by the phenomenon of the universe is not solved by the overmind knowledge. The question in this case, whether the building of thought, experience, world of perceptions of the mental person, the mind, Purusha, is truly a self-expression, a self-determination proceeding from some truth of his own spiritual being, a manifestation of that truth's dynamic possibilities, or whether it is not rather a creation or construction presented to him by nature, by Prakriti, and only in the sense of being individualized in his personal formation of that nature, can it be said to be his own or dependent on him? Or again, it might be a play of a cosmic imagination, a fantasia of the infinite imposed on the blank, indeterminable of his own eternal pure existence. These are the three views of creation that seem to have an equal chance of being right. And mind is incapable of definitely deciding between them. For each view is armed with its own mental logic and its appeal to intuition and experience. Overmind seems to add to the perplexity, for the overmental view of things allows each possibility to formulate itself in its own independent right, and realize its own existence in cognition, in dynamic self-presentation, in substantiating experience.
So this is a very interesting paragraph, in which we find that he moves to the cosmic mind or overmind. And in the overmind, he's looking at a range of the overmind, which is really the summit of overmind. So there also we can sense that there are layers or levels, and the very first sentence makes that clear. Overmind consciousness is such a state or principle beyond individual mind, beyond even universal mind in the ignorance. So this universal mind in the ignorance, it's being presented there because our mind is a personal mind in the ignorance. And this whole notion of the ignorance then becomes very key, because he hasn't yet clarified, at least in this chapter, what that means. But just in passing, one may observe that these are forms of consciousness in which there is conditioning, so that there isn't a clear view of reality. But overmind consciousness, which he has sometimes called the vidya avidya consciousness, vidya dash avidya, or translated the knowledge dash ignorance consciousness, the knowledge ignorance consciousness. He calls it so because in this plane, there is both of them. There is both knowledge and ignorance. Now, what does that mean? Simply put, it's the place or the consciousness in which the one and the many are both present and divided. See? So the one becomes the many, and at a certain point, you have the one, and with all its many possibilities, and at another point, it's as if the one obscures itself, or puts a lid on itself, and only the many remain as individual possibilities. That dividing point is the universal mind and the ignorance, where the many are realities, and the one is obscured. Now, going higher in overmind, we find the one behind the many. And that's the summits of overmind, where it is closest to supermind. The supermind is the home proper of the one that actually differentiates itself into the many. The one and the many are the same in supermind. So here he's going to the summits of overmind, where the ignorance is being overpassed. Now here is where you begin getting, and it's already pretty far above our own, lower altitudes of mind. And you start begin getting a first direct and masterful cognition of cosmic truth. But then, as he's saying over here, here also one does not find the answer to the question that he has laid out, and the three possibilities that he has mentioned continue to operate over here. Now, however, there are some other things that he notes in this paragraph. One is, it is self-evident here that both the individual and the cosmos come from a transcendent reality which takes form in them. In other words, at the summits of overmind, we start seeing what he has laid out as the hypothesis becoming partially visible to us. That is, the essentially folded nature of reality, that every entity within it is just another name and form of its entire self, and every plane in it is another name and form of some of its properties fronting its entire self. So that cosmos and individual are both self-presentations of conscious being. So that is one thing that becomes available to us at that level. The mind and life of the individual being itself in nature must therefore be a partial self-expression of the cosmic being, and both through that and directly a self-expression of the transcendent reality. This is the consequence of that, because if we say that the cosmic planes, whether of matter, life, or the various planes of mind that he identifies, are a self-presentation of transcendent being, as well as if every individual is a self-presentation of transcendent being, then we have set a certain complexity into the picture, because the individual is a part of the cosmos. This is the point that he made earlier, that is it our minds or the cosmic minds figuring itself as us or through us? But here is where a first, deeper truth is making itself visible, because we are a part of the cosmos, but we are also the transcendent being. This is the complexity, that we are a portion of cosmic operation, but in some sense we are greater than the cosmic operation, because the cosmic operation is a self-presentation of the totality of being, but each one of us is also a self-presentation of the totality of being. So this doubleness characterizes the existence of entities in the cosmos, particularly human entities. A doubleness where we have to accept our interdependence on the cosmic unfoldment, but at the same time, we have to accept our independence and our superiority to the entire cosmos by dint of being a direct self-presentation of transcendental being. So this is a certain complexity that he introduces here, which is a very key complexity that gives value to both our dependent nature on the cosmos as well as our fully transcendent natures as beings who can in fact transform the entire cosmos, any one of us for that matter. So that is one very important point over here. And the other one is, of course, the continuation of the three questions or three possibilities that he has laid out. And that is, he ends by saying that the overmind gives full credence to each of them. Because there, where the one is parting into the many, or the one is becoming the many, is the home of the archetypes, or the gods. And these archetypes, each one figures a certain possibility of the Absolute as the fullness of its self-presentation. So each one of these possibilities that he has laid out, and I read them again from this, this paragraph, each one of them is equally possible to overmind. It's only when one enters even higher range that one sees how they are related to each other. So what are these three? The original question set out for us by the phenomenon of the universe is not solved by the overmind knowledge. The question in this case, whether the building of thought, experience, world of perception of the mental person, the mind Purusha, is truly a self-expression, a self-determination proceeding from some truth of his own spiritual being. So this is, like the third option in the previous paragraph. It arises from some self within, or from some self, maybe transcendental self, but it is the self of the person itself. Now one sees that if the person is a self-presentation of transcendental being, then this is true to some extent, because it is coming out of that transcendence, a manifestation of that truth's dynamic possibilities. The second one is, or whether it is not rather a creation or construction presented to him by nature, by prakriti, and only in the sense of being individualized in his personal formation of that nature can it be said to be his own or dependent on him. So this is the one where earlier he was talking about a world energy or a nature energy, evolutionary shakti, which is generating these thoughts as part of nature, and that we are part of it. We are part of the cosmos, and hence we receive what the cosmos gives us and can accept for ourselves what our constitution allows us to accept. And then the third one, or again, it might be a play of a cosmic imagination, a fantasia of the infinite, imposed on the blank indeterminate of his own eternal pure existence. This is the Maya theory. In other words, it is a transcendental freak. It is a kind of not a cosmic, meaningful evolutionary, nor an individual self-expression, but an extra cosmic fantasia without any meaning that is being generated, and we have, we are forced into watching it. In other words, we have to witness something which is meaningless. These are the three views that he's presenting as provisional origins of thought.
Devashish?
Yeah.
Which one of those three in that sentence, in that longer sentence you just read, and also where else in the paragraph, I missed it, did it refer to the archetype? So where in the sentence out of those three does it, or which one of the three views would be best for encapsulating or holding the talking about the archetypes? And where else in this paragraph did it talk about the archetypes or refer or hint at them?
Yeah. Owen, the problem is he has not talked about the archetypes over here. One of the difficulties is that we've jumped into Book 2, Part 1, without going through Book 1, where he has talked about overmind, supermind, etc., to a greater degree. But essentially, where he talks about it or hints about it is in the last part of that paragraph, where he's saying, these are the three views of creation that seem to have an equal chance of being right, and mind is incapable of definitely deciding between them. For each view is armed with its own mental logic and its appeal to intuition and experience. Overmind seems to add to the perplexity, for the overmental view of things allows each possibility to formulate itself in its own independent right and realize its own existence in cognition, in dynamic self-presentation, in substantiating experience. Now these, each possibility formulated in its own independent right, are the archetypes. These are the patterns or cosmic self-presentations that can encapsulate the cosmos and give it a stamp of a certain understanding. Each one of them a relative understanding, but nevertheless a understanding that encompasses the whole cosmos. So these are all co-present in overmind.
So, can you still hear me?
Yeah, I can.
So it sounds like these three are also spoken at more length in Book 1 then, and so they're kind of, all three of these would be considered archetypes of such. Is that right?
Yeah, that is right. That is right. Each of these three could be considered an archetype. Absolutely. Each of these three views is an archetype. And each of them has some provisional truth to it. As he points out, these, each of them standing as, see, this is one of the problems of overmind and the problems of earthly existence as a result, is that each of these archetypes has relative independent existence in overmind. Because from the overmind, the play of relativity is given full scope. Now, what that translates into in our existence, as he's saying, that we cannot decide between these three in the mental consciousness. Mind is incapable of definitely deciding between them. And this is true right up to overmind. And what that means, as far as we are concerned, is that just as we are talking about these folds having certain properties that are expressed and certain properties not available, what is expressed to us in cosmos is a relativity in which each of these archetypes has equal weight and can each generate a philosophy, can each even generate a religion. And that's the problem. The problem is all religions are facets of a whole, but partial facets presenting themselves as the entire whole and not being able to decide between each other as to what is the truth, because none of them is the exclusive truth. And then they fight with each other because we can't decide between them.
Yes.
See, this ultimately, the problem of human conflict rests in the nature of the cosmic evolution and what is expressed in what Sri Aurobindo calls the, that's why it's called the ignorance, avidya, with a capital I. And it's, this is the kind of profundity of this thesis, that he's telling you that it's not possible to arrive at a solution over here. It's possible to arrive at one provisional solution, which is that, you know, given by many of the sages who say, as you're climbing to the mountaintop, the view is different. But if you were to describe it to each other, it would look like you're climbing up different mountains. But if you were to assume or have the faith that you'll get the same total view once you reach the peak, then you can accept each other's views and continue on your path. That's one solution. It's a kind of a coexistence solution. The other solution is, well, we don't accept any of these views to be true at all. That's the Maya solution. And we aim for the peak, completely refusing to look to left or right or to what anybody else says. See, only when we reach the top do we have an answer. Okay, one of the problems with that is we are never really sure whether we reach the top or not. Okay. We can reach some top and start believing that that's the fullness of the answer.
And isn't that kind of the view that everything is Maya and the only thing that is real is God?
The only thing that's real, ultimately it translates to the only thing that's real is the unmanifest, is that which has no relationship with the world. Because if we've already started with the assumption that whatever we view in the world is false, you can never recover it. You've already left it behind.
So that's kind of like a neo Advaita kind of non-dualist perspective in a sense.
Yeah, it's the Advaitic perspective. Neo-Advaita is a new formulation to the Advaita, but it continues to be the same. Yeah.
So, Devajita, it's 9:30, but if people don't mind, perhaps we can read the next paragraph too and have the discussion for it next time.
Sure.
Somebody wants to read Matteo?
Okay. In overmind, in all the higher ranges of the mind, we find recurring the dichotomy of a pure, silent self, without feature or qualities or relations, self-existent, self-poised, self-sufficient, and the mighty dynamis of a determinative knowledge power, of a creative consciousness and force which precipitates itself into the forms of the universe. This opposition, which is yet a collocation, as if these two were correlatives or complementaries, although apparent contradictions of each other, sublimates itself into the coexistence of an impersonal Brahman without qualities, a fundamental divine reality free from all relations or determinants, and a Brahman with infinite qualities, a fundamental divine reality who is the source and container and master of all relations and determinations, nirguna, saguna. If we pursue the nirguna into a farthest possible self-experience, we arrive at a supreme absolute void of all relations and determinations, the ineffable first and last word of existence. If we enter through the saguna into some ultimate possible of experience, we arrive at a divine absolute, a personal supreme and omnipresent Godhead, transcendent as well as universal, an infinite master of all relations and determinations, who can uphold in his being a million universes and pervade each with a single ray of his self-light and a single degree of his ineffable existence. The overmind consciousness maintains equally these two truths of the eternal, which face the mind as mutually exclusive alternatives. It admits both as supreme aspects of one reality. Somewhere, then, behind them, there must be a still greater transcendence which originates them or upholds them both in its supreme eternity. But what can that be of which such opposites are equal truths, unless it be an original indeterminable mystery of which any knowledge, any understanding by the mind is impossible? We can know it indeed to some degree in some kind of experience or realization by its aspects, powers, constant series of fundamental negatives and positives through which we have to pursue it independently in either or integrally in both together. But in the last resort, it seems to escape even from the highest mentality and remain unknowable.
So we can resume this paragraph next time, but it's a nice conclusion to our discussion, because he points out here that even in the summits of overmind, we find these two self-presentations, one which is completely what we discussed just some time back, the Advaitic realization of existence as a featureless unknowable, the nirguna aspect, and the other in which it is a all-inclusive Vishwarupa of some infinite being that contains and pervades many cosmoses, every cosmos, you know, that is possible. And so again, these two summit dichotomies, ultimately a impersonal infinite and a personal infinite, again, translating itself into an impersonal cosmos without end and a personal being, the who and the what, leaves us at the summits without any answer to the question of origin regarding the phenomena or energies that are manifesting here.
So thank you, Devashita. We'll stop here and we'll continue on the fourth Saturday, which I guess is 2 weeks from now on the 27th. Is that okay?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I think that's what it is. It's the 27th. Sure.
So let's connect again 27th Saturday at 8 a.m.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you, Devada.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you very much.